Monica Wild, herbalist, author, and all-around good person, joining us here at the Think Boot Camp podcast. So Mo, as you're known as, please say hi to the folks and give us a little background on who you are.
Oh, hello, everyone. It's afternoon here in Scotland. And I'm a research herbalist, which basically means I've got a master's degree in herbal medicine. And I work here in Scotland. I'm part of the Clade Clinic. And really, my specialism is Borrelia and the other, well, the Lyme co-infection group, you know, the Lyme complex, as I call it.
All right. And we actually first found you on our radar when we interviewed Dr. Jack Lambert. He spoke very highly of you on his podcast. So why don't you share a little bit about how you and Dr. Lambert have worked together in the past?
Yeah, well, back in 2019, I'd just come back from the States where I had been visiting with Julie McIntyre. Now, those of you who know that Stephen Booner's work will know that, you know, Julie is an incredible herbalist who'd worked alongside him. And she told me that she was going to stop seeing patients. And, you know, I'd followed their work for many years. And I realized that, you know, when you're dealing with complex things, you have to really focus on that to such an extent that you start to see patterns. So I'd come back and I'd made this decision to myself that for a while I was just only going to see people with Lyme disease and to see if I could tease out these patterns and understand, you know, what was going on. And literally about, you know, a couple of weeks after making that decision, a patient came to me and told me that she was also seeing Dr. Lambert in Ireland and that he was actually quite open and receptive to a lot of the herbs and supplements that people had been telling him they were taking alongside and might be open to speaking to a herbalist. And I thought that was really interesting because when I did my master's, I actually did integrated medicine. So I looked at the beneficial concomitant prescribing of drugs with herbs, with micronutrients, with supplements. So I got in touch with him and basically went over to Ireland. And over the course of that year, I made a few trips over to Ireland. I went and sat in his, you know, shadowed him, sat in his clinic. We spent a lot of time talking around that and started, you know, collaborating with patients that we were seeing together. And that has really grown now. I normally have a formal call with him. We have a MDT, a multidisciplinary team meeting once every 2 weeks with myself and the other herbalists who work with me now to talk about any mutual patients, obviously with their consent. But what it means is that we're actually able to you know, complement each other. And more importantly, we base our treatment around what the patient needs. You know, this is very much patient-led medicine, as opposed to trying to squeeze every patient into a one-size-fits-all standard protocol, which, you know, does work for some people, but not all of them, really depending on what has brought them to this disease in the first place, which is, you know, very long topic.
Yes. This is so exciting. And unfortunately, I got a little ahead of myself because sometimes I get excited. I forget about, you know, being as polite as I should be. And so I want to apologize to my co-host, Cassidy Colbert, one of my favorite people in the world, who is with us today. So Cassidy, you want to say hi to the folks before we move forward with this very exciting interview?
Hello, everyone. I am so excited to be here. I've already been taking notes as you've been speaking, Mo. So I'm excited to see where we end up today.
Yes, it's very exciting. So thank you, Cassidy. So Mo, let's walk this back a little bit and talk about your background. Talk about where you grew up and what, first of all, brought you to the community of herbal medicine.
Gosh, well, I'm 60 now. And if you go all the way back, I grew up in Kenya. And yeah, I was born in the UK, but then we went to Kenya when I was about six, which is where my grandfather had been for many years. And so I was sort of introduced to people working with herbs at that age. You know, a lot of the people around us, you know, used herbal medicine. And when I was sent back to the UK to go to school, I also met women who were using bits of herbal medicine. You know, by then it was the 70s, and there was that, you know, back to the good life sort of interest in herbs again. And I kind of thought it was just normal that before you went to a doctor, you'd go and try some herbal teas or something. But I didn't actually realize that you could study to be a herbalist. I actually wanted to be a vet, but unfortunately, it wasn't. I wasn't encouraged to do sciences. The outlook for a lot of women of my generation was, you know, go and be a housewife or do a secretarial course or something. I mean, we weren't even allowed to have bank accounts without a man's permission when I was 12. You know, you've got to remember that this has all changed very much recently. So I did different things when I left school, mainly working in design and marketing. And it wasn't until I came to Edinburgh in 1995 that I realized that you could actually train to be a herbalist. There was such a thing as a qualified herbalist. So I'd read everything that I could possibly read, and I'd continued to, you know, I'd studied a lot on my own because I have that sort of mind. You know, I'm not neurodominant, and you know, I tend to hyper focus on things and really go into them. I mean, right behind me now, you can see a wall of books. And I couldn't start training straight away because I had three young children I was bringing up on my own at the time. My youngest, who's my daughter, actually contracted Lyme later on in life, but not until after I'd studied training. And so I did my master's degree quite late. And after that, because there's a big research focus to that, and that's something, you know, that hyper focus on things is something that my brain's, you know, really quite good at. I was sort of looking for something to, you know, really focus on. And around that time, around the time that I did my master's, so I started my master's when I was 50, never too late. And I'd met a patient with Lyme disease, and he knew he had Lyme disease, but the antibiotics, the 4 weeks of doxycycline, hadn't been very successful, and he was really suffering. And I had no idea what to do. You know, I really didn't know. And Bill, I still send my humble apologies out to you in the universe. But because I, you know, tend to get really gripped by things, that really haunted me for a couple of years, that I did not know what this was or how to deal with it or how to approach it. And then in 2016, no, hang on, it was a little later than that, about 2018, Julie McIntyre was over in London teaching. And so I went on a course with her, and we also got on like a house on fire. Stephen Booner had been brilliantly supportive to me for many years because I'd been dealing with some intractable antibiotic resistant infections before that. So that's really how I got
Lyme.
that far. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's before Cassidy takes you through some of the work you did on the Buna protocol and some of the training you did there, I still want to spend a little bit more time with your background. So you're working as an herbalist before you went to back to university to get your master's degree. Talk to us about or were you not? So what were you doing between the time that you had earned your bachelor's degree and the time that you had earned your master's degree?
Yeah, so I didn't earn a bachelor's degree. I actually had to apply to, when I did my master's, I actually had to apply on a to do an in vivo. Because at the time that I came back to Scotland, I was in my early 30s, and I went to work for a herbalist company, a very old company here called Napier's, which has been going for about 160 years, you know, since 1860. And that was where I met people who had, you know, qualified to be herbalists. And I started working for them. And I basically started to look after the production and the licensing. So I, for instance, did the pharmacovigilance and all the liaison with the MRHA, which is the Medicines Regulatory Health Authority. So I wasn't seeing patients at that time, But I was doing everything else but,
Right. So, so.
everything else but, and also looking after the helpline. But unfortunately, by the time that my children were old enough for me to go into full-time study, most of the courses had closed down. Now they have recently, the bachelor's degree level courses have recently started up again, but we went through a period where a lot of the courses were closed down. There was some pressure by certain scientists who don't like herbal medicine, where I think universities were told that their scientific research funding might be endangered if they carried on keeping up these herbal courses. We'd lobbied for herbalists to be regulated by the government and had got as far with the last Labour government of them agreeing to do so, because herbalists should be accountable to the public. They should be on the healthcare professions register. And unfortunately, just before it was enacted, there was a change of government and the Conservatives threw it back out. That was 14 years ago. So, unable to actually find a course to go on, what I actually did was I applied to the masters, but of course, I had to show them that I was equivalently able and equivalently qualified. And so, I'd done a lot of other courses on, anatomy, on physiology, and how everything worked, because being a herbalist is not just about knowing about herbs, it's also understanding how the body works.
Right. So, as a medical herbalist, so you had this. I just want folks to sort of see how this is developing. So you grew up in Africa, and when you were growing up in Africa, you saw that that herbal medications and herbal medicines was a part of the culture and the medical culture. You then came to you came back home to the UK. You were educated, and you always had this interest in herbal medicine, and I guess in part because of your culture and your background, which then brought you to work at a company, an herbal company, one of the oldest, I guess, in the world. And you were still felt called to take the next step, to move forward in developing what you were created to do, right? To work in the herbal community. And the two things I want to talk to you about before we invite Cassidy to come in. And the first thing is certifications, right? And I think we can look at certifications one of two ways, right? There is some sense that certifications, unfortunately, can be negative because government is then controlling large segments of the economy that maybe they should or shouldn't be in control of. But on the other side of the coin, the community of people who are purchasing services will have a certain level of confidence when there is a standard for defining what is a qualified person in a particular field, or what is not a qualified person in a particular field. And when we're looking at medical treatment, I do think the case can be made that it's very important to set up standards of care and qualifications and testing so that folks know what it is that they're going to be purchasing when they purchase medical services. So give me your thoughts on why you think it might benefit the Lyme disease community to have governmental intervention at the regulatory phase for herbalists.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. It's a big argument, and there are a lot of pros and cons. On one hand, if there is a regulatory body, and in the UK there's the National Institute of Medical Herbalists and the College of Phytotherapy Practitioners, there are self-governing bodies that herbalists join and belong to. People really should know what level of qualification somebody has. Because in some cases it can be really critical to health. Some people get very enthusiastic and they don't necessarily know when their own limits are. One of the reasons that I like working with a team, because I have a team of seven, I'm one of seven herbalists and we work together, is that if I ever feel out of my depth, I'm not ashamed to say, actually, I think you'd be better seeing somebody else. I don't think I know it all. But sometimes people can get, they can think they know more than they do. And if you don't understand what they know and what their qualifications are, you can end up entrusting your health to somebody who doesn't really know what they're doing. The difficulty on the other side is that if it's very, very regulated, you will then find the, say for instance, the government regulates herbalists who are treating Lyme. You'll then find that you end up with this problem like you do with, ILETs amongst the doctors, whereby it's, well, you can only do evidence-based stuff. Now, in terms of herbalism, the evidence for how it works with Lyme disease has come out after the work that, for instance, Stephen Booner did over 20 years. If it hadn't been for him, working with patients and working with these herbs, the researchers would never have got the idea to actually test things like Cryptolepis, which is antimicrobial against the, the three main co-infections. So you run the risk of stifling creativity. So it's a really tricky balance, and government control isn't always the best thing. Strong self-certifying or governing bodies, I think, are. And to have them liaise with patient groups, I think, is really important too.
Right. So, of course, on the one side of the coin, it is really important to have regulation when it relates to qualifications, because that, I think, brings a discipline to a place where it receives the adequate respect it should in a particular community. On the other side of the coin, when we have too much government regulation, we often have situations where, and we've seen in the Lyme community, unfortunately, too often, where the generally accepted medical practices that are imposed upon the practitioners by education departments and by regulatory agencies then stifle the tools that practitioners can use, or they'll be delicensed or sued, right? So we sort of have to find a way of striking the balance. But I do think, quite frankly, in the herbal community, there would be a lot of benefit to setting up regulation for qualifications, so that herbalists would receive adequate respect from the patient community and from the traditional medical practitioners. Because I do think, and I'd like your reaction to another issue that we deal with here at Tick Boot Camp, which is team approach. You were talking about your team, meaning the other people that you work with. We here at Tick Boot Camp had found that in most cases, the people who have the best outcomes are people who are working with a team of practitioners, meaning they're the owner of the team, right? And we often argue, if you're going to go on this journey, you need to have a medical doctor. If you're going to go on this journey, you need to have a psychologist or a psychiatrist that you're working with. And what I want to add to that, or what I want to bolt onto that framework now, is you really need to have an herbalist, right? You need to have all three of those practitioners that you're working with, because what we don't see working well for the folks that we interface with over the last several years is people who use the do-it-yourself model, right? Because every single business is going to be built around either a do-it-yourself model, a do-it-together model, or a done-for-you model. And we know that the done-for-you model doesn't exist in the medical community any longer. So we really have to sort of step it down and take responsibility for our own care, but build a team of practitioners that we're going to do it together with. They're the people who have the best outcome, and we really want to bolt on the herbalist approach, because medical doctors are not given adequate training with this set of tools that is particular to your discipline. So give me your thoughts on that observation.
Well, it certainly works better when you have a team. I mean, I know you're in the States, and I know a very good doctor in the States called Ron Stram, and at his clinic you see him, and he's a very well qualified doctor. You also have an appointment with the nutritionist, and you have an appointment with a psychologist, and he also prescribes not just antibiotics, but herbs and supplements as well. And that integrated medicine model, I think, is definitely the way of the future. I mean, certainly endorsed by the United Nations and the World Health Authority. And unless conventional medicine does think it has all the answers, and most of the doctors that I know, who I either work with or who are my patients, would be the first people to say we don't have all the answers, that it behoves us to have these integrated systems. And I think in the States, I think there's the American Herbalist Guild, the AHG. And that's certainly one way of seeing, you know, if your herbalist is a practitioner qualified with the AHG, I think you'll find that does give the level of training that you're looking for without there being government intervention.
So Ma, one of the challenges that we have here in the US is we have this perspective on specialists. And I think you use a term in one of your videos that I had reviewed. And by the way, you have some brilliant material on YouTube. I want to urge our listeners to find you on YouTube. Really, really brilliant pieces that you've put out there. I don't know if you use the term silo. I don't remember the exact term you used, but you're
Siloed medicine. Yes, it's. I sometimes with some of my Lyme patients, you know, before they come to me, you know, they, you know, the first hour I spend with them, they're telling me about the journey. And for some of them, it's like it's imagining that if your body's a car that's broken down, you go to your general medicine practitioner, and you say, the car won't start, it's broken. What do I do? And he says, I'm not sure what it is. I'm going to send you off to see a specialist. And you go to see this chap, and he looks at the spark plugs. And he says, it's not the spark plugs. You go, great, what is it then? He says, well, I don't know. I'm just the spark plug specialist. And you go back to your GP, and he sends you to the carburetor specialist. You imagine if we try to fix cars like that. You know, we actually just want one mechanic who's going to be able to really spend some time under the hood and find out what's wrong. But the difficulty in modern medicine, and this is really not just medicine, but it's our society as a whole, is that we've gone down this sort of left brain, very reductionist path with so many things. And, you know, evidence-based, narrowing down into one thing. And that basically means that the people who are respected as medical doctors, you know, become consultants and specialists in their area. But in terms of being able to actually look across and connect all the things together, you've got sort of, you know, GPs who are the sort of entry level. You've got people in palliative care who are dealing with polypharmacy and people at accident and emergency. But there's no sort of grand vizier consultant that looks across everything. And quite often, you know, your infectious disease consultant won't really want to step on your neurological consultant's toes, who won't really want to step on your endocrinologist consultant's toes. But Lyme, you know, Lyme isn't a reductionist thing. Lyme affects all the systems of the body. I mean, I'm all for clinically based medicine, but to me, that means also evidence from practice as well as evidence from randomized controlled trials. Because, you know, with a randomized controlled trial, you can go down the route of eliminating all the things that might confound the trial. But the one thing that you can never eliminate is the non-standardization of the people that you're experimenting on. You know, you can take 10 women who all weigh 70 kilos, and each one of them will be a different shape or size. You know, and it's the same with Lyme. You know, it's a multi-systemic illness. Depending on what you know, where you got bitten and where the infection has ended up in your body, depending on what your health was like, both your mental health, your lifestyle health, as well as your body's health and your genetic heritage, what that was like before you get to being bitten by that tick. You know, all of these create this sort of you know, inter-systemic effect, which isn't so easy just to say, well, here's one little cog and we're going to fix it. So medicine has become really very siloed. And I think this is why, you know, if I was going to go back now and be 20 all over again, I'd go and study Chinese medicine first. Chinese medicine in its purest form is basically the study of patterns and the recording of patterns over 3,500 years, all written meticulously down before people could actually look inside the body or go off and get a blood test. You know, now people rely very much on blood tests. A patient yesterday was telling me that, you know, her even though she'd had a tick bite and had classic symptoms, because her tests were negative, she hadn't yet made antibodies. The doctor said he couldn't prescribe her antibiotics. You know, what happened to the clinical judgment? How did we manage before we even looked inside the body? You know, Lyme disease goes back to about 8,000 years ago. You know, they found in Ötzi the Iceman. They found evidence of Lyme and also evidence that he'd had acupuncture.
Yes, yes, which is really exciting. And we know from some of the work that, you know, Bill Ross, for example, has done, that you know, the ticks have been biting people as long as there have been people. The Lyme bacteria is certainly, you know, there's some fossil evidence at the Museum of Natural History here in New York that demonstrates that ticks harboring Lyme are over 3 million years old. So, you know, there have been ticks biting humans as long as there have been humans, and we have been interfacing with at least one of the bacteria that we define as part of the Lyme spectrum of bacteria for as long as we've been alive, as long as there have been humans. So, Mo, I want to take you ask you one more question before Cassidy walks you through your journey with your training with Lyme, and that is, how do you define Lyme disease? And do you think one of the problems we have in the Lyme disease community is that it's a disease without a definition, or is it a disease with many different definitions? And because it has so many different definitions, it's really hard to sort of stick a fork in it when we have agencies like the Center for Disease Control in the U.S. defining it as a disease caused by one strain of one bacteria. It could be acute, it could be chronic, although there's some debate about whether or not there's even some acceptance of the chronic condition in the U.S. And should we be using the Alan MacDonald approach, which is we should be arguing that we should be divorcing from Lyme disease, divorcing from the term, rather than embracing the term?
Well, I think above all things, unless it's treated in the acute stage, I think how you could describe Lyme is long. You know, it's long. And we know that the long response to bacteria and viruses is not just limited to Lyme. You know, you can get long COVID, you can have long Ebola, long chikungunya, long dengue. Basically, what you have is a disease where, in this particular case, a bacteria, a tick-borne bacteria, and that could be Borrelia, but it can also be Bartonella or Babesia, but a tick-borne bacteria has caused the body to become severely out of balance. Viruses do the same thing. The big difference is that unless the bacteria are treated, they are going to carry on disrupting the body with more frequency than viruses, although some viruses can come back up again if the immune system is low. They don't last continuously quite as long, you know, so bacteria have a different form. And my view of it is that, you know, you have to treat the bacteria for sure, you know, and that's why most people are given antibiotics. But antibiotics only do one thing: they kill bacteria. What they don't do is pull the system back into balance again. Now, if you've not been ill for too long, or if you had a really strong immune system before this happened, you know, chances are that, you know, once the bacteria are killed with antibiotics, you could get back into that balance yourself. But the majority of people can't do it on their own, because the things that made them susceptible to the bacteria in the first place weakened their body in the first place. So one of the, to try and explain this a little bit better, well, if you look in the research literature from about the 90s, you know, Lyme had first been discovered in Lyme, Connecticut, and over here people were, you know, rightly concerned that if Lyme started to be a thing and you had lots of workers in forestry and other things like that getting sick, there's going to be lots of occupational health lawsuits. So they actually went around and they did a lot of testing on people working outdoors, people working in forestry and things like that. And they were using, the IgG, IgM sort of test for antibodies and things, which isn't the most sophisticated of testing. But what they generally found was that probably about between 20 and 25% of people working in forestry in Europe had contracted Lyme disease at one point. They had the antibiotics, they've been bitten by a tick, they've had this disease. But only about 3% in the UK had symptoms. So obviously a lot of people were getting bit, getting the disease, and their immune system was overcoming it. But there were a few people that weren't. And this is always the question that you start with, is why, when you were bitten by a tick and you got Lyme, but why did your body not have the capacity to overcome it? And that is the starting point at which you start to tease out the threads and unravel the pattern of this person and then start to find the right way of treating them. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's everything that I want someone to say, you've said. So so many thoughts and questions running around in my head, but I think this is the perfect time to then talk about you fully immersing yourself into the Lyme world and the Lyme treatment. And I know you had said you had that one patient back in, I think you had said like 2016 or 2018, and you didn't know how to help them. So after that is when you truly dove in. And when did you, can you walk through that little process a little bit more in depth? And you're working with Julian, how you came out on the other side. What did you learn from that? And then how did that lead you to where you are now?
Yeah, so I first saw Bill in it was either 2015 or 2016, and I wasn't able to help. And I'm the sort of girl that just doesn't like questions that have no answers. I'm really stubborn like that. You know, I got chucked out a load of classes at school for questioning the immutable laws of the universe and things like that. And it really bugged me that I didn't have, that I didn't understand this, that I didn't have those answers. And so I did the training in 2018 and just, it was so illuminating that, yeah, there are ways of approaching it, there are ways of handling it, but there's lots of different moving parts. And I'd been such an admirer of Stephen and Julie's work for so long as well. And I think it was really because, I knew, unfortunately, Stephen passed away just over about a year and a half ago now. And he'd become unwell. It wasn't widely known then. And Julie was giving up the practice. And I just thought, with them not so engaged now, I wasn't sure that there was somebody who was really giving just Lyme this massive beam of attention that was necessary to carry on that work. And I think also because I'd come late to my qualification, because I'd done it in a slightly back to front way as well, I was also very sensitive to the fact that I didn't have the breadth of experience for doing lots and lots of different things. If you came to me with, endometriosis, I'd really ask you to go and see one of my colleagues or something. It suited my training and it suited my brain just to really, really focus. And I'd met Dr. Lambert that year, and that really interested me because that idea of collaborative working, was something I was really interested in. And then the following summer, my daughter got bitten by a tick. And lo and behold, my daughter got Lyme disease as well. So, I suppose that was why. But I think the biggest driver for me, the thing that drives me the most, is seeing patients whom everybody else has told that they're not going to recover or they can't get better, seeing them get better. I mean, for me, that's the biggest buzz. So often people give up. You've been ill for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. You don't think you're ever going to get better. And I can sense that in my patients. It's a real barrier to healing, to not believe, to not trust your body, to not believe that you can get better. And you know, and I'm quite frank with my patients. I say to them, do you not believe you can get better? They'll go, well, I've tried everything. I don't really know. And I say, well, look, I wouldn't waste my time doing this if I didn't, if I didn't know that within you is the capacity to get better. And it's, sometimes when people realize that, you just see that, they get a new burst of energy for the process of healing. It's the hardest work in the world, being a patient. So much is asked of you at your weakest and most vulnerable time. But that belief that you are going to recover, that you can make that journey, is absolutely critical.
I often say, as I said to you offline before we started recording, that I've been doing Chinese medicine and herbal medicine integrative for the last 7 or 8 years. And I always say to people that like start that journey, because people I have a lot of Lyme people that reach out and ask for recommendations for what to do. No matter what treatment you're doing, if you don't believe it's going to work, it's not going to work, because you have that, as like you said, like that's such a huge kind of aspect of it, is the belief that you are going to get better in some shape or form, in the mind over matter kind of aspect of it. And that's just my experience with it, I think happens with me. But I, when you, this is just a kind of my own personal question for you. If when you have patients come to you, is it normally after they have seen all the other kinds of doctors and practitioners, and then they come to you as like the last hope? Do you wish that they would start with you?
I wish everybody would start with a herbalist, to be quite honest. I really do. Herbalists are trained not just in herbs, but they're trained like doctors. They have to go and study the human body, the systems. They study nutrition. I can't overestimate how important nutrition is and the gut. Our founder in 1860 used to always bang on, the seat of your health is your gut. And that was before we even knew about the gut microbiome and things like that. But what a herbalist can do right from the beginning is look at the whole picture and start to see what needs adjusting. What's going to need to be brought in. And if you just go and try and focus on one thing, I mean, it's like biofilm busting. That's a people go, well, am I going to get some biofilm busters? And I'm like, do you know something? If you can't walk and you're crawling along on your belly and you see a little hole where a snake lives, do you go and put a stick in there, before you can run? No. What we need to do is we need to get you to a point where you actually have some strength and resilience. And then on our own terms, we can go and actually maybe plan to deliberately provoke, get some of them back into the bloodstream so that we can kill them again. You can really hurt yourself if you start going to, doing the things in the wrong order. If you keep focusing on, biofilm busting and provoking stuff, and you keep making yourself sort of ill over and over again, and you don't attend to the rest of the things, you're not going to make a lot of progress. And it's the same with only using antimicrobial herbs. In Chinese medicine, we call these cold. Now, imagine what happens if you jump into a cold loch. There's plenty of them here in Scotland. What happens to your skin? Everything tightens up, shrinks, and forms a barrier to keep the warmth in or the cold out. In Chinese medicine, they believe if you take too many cold and bitter herbs, the tissues of your body literally, have that same, effect. So you're setting up a type of antimicrobial resistance, or you're causing damage. So what you actually have to do is you have to balance those cold antimicrobial herbs, that work really well. I mean, cryptolepis is just, it's an amazing herb, but you need to balance them with herbs that will warm it, that will keep the tissues moist, that will move, the blood around the system. Even before you start looking at which particular systems are affected, and this takes people who really understand physiology, not just herbs, but physiology.
I really love the whole body aspect. What you said earlier about how the one size fits all approach doesn't really work. And I fully have seen that, at least in my experience as well. And I think it's so important to look at Lyme is a multi-system infection, so you have to look at them all. And you said earlier about how Chinese medicine was based off of patterns. And I'm wondering, since you have been treating just the Lyme, what patterns have you seen come about in patients and their kind of how the system, how the infection works through their systems and the, I guess, like extra things going on within their immune system, how have those played out?
Well, there are quite a few different patterns and not everybody experiences all of them. But I mean, I can certainly highlight a couple of typical ones. So one would be the hyperactivity of the immune system. So basically what happens is that, you know, every time that you go into stress, you know, your immune system goes on the alert, ready to cause inflammation. You know, we think of, you know, it's a very old part, our immune system, and it's really only dealing with saber-toothed tigers and things like that. And for people who are particularly anxious or people whose immune systems have been out of balance before, but also the very nature of having Lyme, where it suppresses your immune system, but your immune system's really smart. The Lyme may be suppressed and hidden, but it still knows that something else is going on. So what happens is that you get into this sort of Th1, Th2 dominant attack side of the immune system, where, you know, it's getting ready to defend itself from a tiger. So there's lots of inflammation because it's going to send, you know, blood to the area and heal up wounds and close everything down. But what happens is that it doesn't really get a chance to then relax and go back into the rebalancing part where the immune system becomes sort of stable. So because this is a podcast, you can't see I'm talking with my hands here, but it's a bit like driving a car with a clutch, you know, in that when the two are out all the time, you end up with an immune system that's hyperactive. And it becomes hugely sensitive. It can become really sensitive to histamine and other things with foods. You then go into sort of mast cell activation syndrome. Eventually you end up with autoimmune because these sentries in the body become so trigger happy that they end up shooting themselves. Mm-hmm. And you see this pattern in people who become hypersensitive to molds and fragrances and their environment, but also hypersensitive to herbs, you know, so they feel as if they're herxing even on one drop of a herb. But in actual fact, their body is so hyper alert that it's like, I don't want it. You know, I'm really unsure about this. And you've got a lot of work to do just to really calm everything down, to get their immune system really strong and to calm everything down. So that's one pattern that you do see a lot of. And until you get their immune system calmed down, it can really limit the amount of treatment that you can give them. Another one is people who've had treatment and they've had so much treatment that the infection is probably at a very, very low level. But they just don't get strong again. They're just weak. Very often they'll get back a certain amount of energy and then they'll start doing something and they'll collapse at a sort of, you know, their muscles will go really weak, their legs will go really weak or wobbly. And sometimes that's neurological as well. And that is, if you look at Chinese medicine, you know, that's a injury between the stomach system and the spleen system. So in Chinese medicine, you have to think of these as not organs, but systems. You know, if the stomach system has become damaged, it cannot provide nutrients to the spleen system, which can then not make blood, which can then not provide energy to the body. And you do see this as well, in that people can actually have problems digesting foods, either because they're not broken down. So digestive enzymes are really helpful, particularly if they've also got histamine, things like diamine oxidase enzyme, and sometimes hydrochloric acid and things. But if there's been inflammation in the gut, you know, an inflamed gut isn't going to let anything pass. And so that's got to be calmed down. So it doesn't matter if your diet's really good. If you're not able to assimilate those nutrients, you're going to have that weakness. And gradually that's going to, you know, affect the ability of the blood to get nutrients into the mitochondria as well. And that's another pattern that can be really difficult to treat too. So, yeah. But these are very much long patterns as opposed to the acute patterns that people are more commonly think of.
As someone who has presented with both of those patterns, some of them, that's really poignant. When you're talking about you have to calm the nervous system down, what is your approach? Because I think that's something that in my later years with the Lyme is something that I didn't realize that I needed to be doing. And there's so many people that I have spoken to within the community that also have come to that realization. I think a lot in part two, the Tick Bootcamp podcast, sharing information that we didn't previously have, but just speaking with one another and going through each other's healing journeys, that's something that a lot of practitioners forget to talk to us about and how you have to heal that aspect of it. So how do you help your patients, or what guidance do you give them with calming the whole system?
Yeah, it's difficult because stress is so endemic in modern society that we no longer think of it as stress. But basically, you know, for the last 300,000 years, we've lived, you know, quite quietly as hunter-gatherers. And now, you know, you put on the television at breakfast time and there's sirens and bombs and wars. And, you know, you walk to work and there's traffic and people you don't know. And, you know, all of these stimuli around us have meant that for most people's, immune system is always in a slight state of hyper anyway. And that's before they get ill. So I think, you know, some of it to start with is, first of all, admitting that you possibly could do some work on your stress and on the psychological aspects of it. And this can be very difficult to broach with patients sometimes, because particularly for patients who are quite highly strung or have had a lot of the mental health side effects of having a bacteria in your body, you know, which is very real. A lot of doctors will have either directly or by implication have suggested that this illness might be all in their head, you know, and you've had to really fight to be believed that this is a physical illness, not a psychological illness. So, you know, when your herbalist suggests that you might want to work on some of the psychological aspects of it, it's not always well received. But nevertheless, you know, the brain is an integral part of the process. It's unfortunate that we have necks, because the only reason we have a neck is so that we can swivel the brain in our head, which is very close to the eyes and the ears, which we need to defend ourselves with. And we can swivel around. And that way people can say, well, you know, it's all in your head. But if your brain was actually located next to your heart and a little bit further away, nobody would ever dream of saying it's all in your head. They would recognize that the brain is actually the controller for the nervous system and the endocrine system. And it's making amazing little chemicals and neurotransmitters and things. And it has to be looked after in just the same way, because, you know, it's also capable of upsetting the whole show. And it's not all in your head, but it does require certain balance. So a lot of my patients, I get them to do something like autogenic training, because whereas meditation is lovely and doing yoga is lovely and bringing these sort of more relaxing practices into your life is great, most people also need a tool that they can put into place now at this exact moment of crisis to calm down. And it was a training that I was lucky enough to, I think I was about 32, and my son, my eldest, had hit puberty, which was not a pleasant experience. And I had three kids I was bringing up on my own, and I ended up in, you know, having this floods of tears and crawling off to my GP, who sent me to a psychiatrist. And he said, well, he said, the bad news is you've got depression. The good news is we've got Prozac. And I was like, meh, really? And my GP at the time, they were running a pilot in autogenic training. And I went off and I did a 9-week course. And it turned me from being a rather anxious mum to being, you know, somebody who's as cool as a cucumber pretty much most of the time. Because you learn this facility to literally put your body into a completely relaxed state on command, you know. And then there are other things. I think there are programs that people run, DRNS. You know, there are other things that you can do. And, you know, each person will find their own. But you have to realize that with, you know, with things like anxiety, you know, if you've been anxious all your life, you may think that that's just the way you are, that you were born like that. But it's not. It's a bad habit. You know, it's possibly a habit you learned from your parent. But I ask my patients, I say, so, you know, who was the anxious one, your mum or your dad? who did you pick up this habit from? Because it's like smoking cigarettes. You know, you've got to realize at some point in your life that it really isn't helpful and it's time to give it up. And just like giving up smoking, it can be hard to give up anxiety because it feels like it's become part of you. But yeah, you can learn to be anxiety free in the same way that you can be nicotine free. You know, and that helps to calm your immune system down because you haven't got a little saber-toothed tiger jumping out, you know, behind every thought that you have and putting your body back into an inflammatory position.
Wow. You keep talking about things that I've experienced and I'm just blown away by everything.
You can also, at the same time, you know, at the beginning when it's difficult, you know, when people are just, first of all, starting to learn more about how their immune system reacts to their thoughts, you can also use, you know, herbs which help to, you know, calm the immune system down, which can, you know, change your mental state, but which aren't addictive, which aren't cumulative.
Yep. With the Lyme aspect of it all, what is the biggest lesson that you think you have learned so far with your work with Lyme and Lyme patients? And then on the other side, what is the biggest challenge that you still see with the Lyme treatment, the Lyme patients that they are facing, but also you as the practitioner are facing?
Well, I suppose the biggest lesson is always listen to your patients. You know, they do understand and know what's going on in their bodies. But you also, at the same time, you must listen, but also you also have to hold on to your own truths and understanding about that. You know, because they are able to tell you and you should listen, but you also then have to translate and interpret that for them to take them down the direction of healing. And the biggest challenge is, I think for people is cost. It's so expensive to be a patient. You know, if you're outside of insurance, you know, it's so expensive. And it is hard to cherry pick your way through that because, you know, when people are vulnerable, there's a lot of people out there to make a lot of money as well. And there's incredibly good practitioners and good supplements and things out there, but there's also a lot of stuff that is very expensive and very substandard. And some that might even be downright dangerous. So I think that's a real challenge. And until the medical profession is willing to admit that this is a problem, and I think with long COVID, that's making the mainstream medical profession start to have to adjust, because this happened on such a scale that they have to step back and go, yeah, these long illnesses, these long diseases, you know, are not just all in their patients' minds, but we've still got a lot of work to get it there.
Yeah, definitely. I also think that there's been a shift, I feel, in the last few years that I'm hoping is for the better. Another question that popped up in my head while you were speaking on that was, how do you deal with the people that don't see herbs as a true, like, medical form and don't see it as a real option? I feel like that is, at least in the US, if you tell people that you're doing herbs, they just give you the look, kind of. That's just why, or how do you know that those are working? What, like, why just you get the look sometimes. They just, or they think it's hoodooey voodooey witchcraft, kind of.
Well, unfortunately, not everybody can study science. I mean, you just have to accept that not everybody, knows enough about things to give you a, the right opinion. I mean, I can explain it. I do remember. Oh, I can be a bit cheeky in social situations if people are being a bit arsy with me, to be quite honest. And I do remember somebody. I think I went to one of those networking functions that the bank invited me to, or something, when I was running Napier's. And there was a chap who came up to me. I think he ran a construction company or something. And he said, "Oh, hello, what do you do?" And I said, "Well, I run a herbal medicine company." And he said, "Oh, really? Does it work?" That's like, I didn't want to say to him, "Do your buildings stay up?" So I just said to him, "Well, have you ever smoked a joint?" And he looked horrified, didn't want to answer that. And I said, "Well, surely you've eaten Brussels sprouts." I said, "Either way, you'll certainly know that both have an effect on the body. Yes, herbal medicine works." But I try not to be quite so naughty most of the time.
Well, it's really nice that you British folks are so polite. And I do think we should talk about this from a mindset standpoint, because one of the things that we've seen with folks who are in the later stages of their healing journey is they do become agnostic to treatment and tools. But unfortunately, very early on in the process, they are very much like the construction professional that you came in contact with. And I think it's important for us to talk about that, because the sooner you get to a point where you understand that you're going to have to step out of the limited traditional frameworks that are generally defined as generally accepted medical practices, and be open to the broader range of treatment tools that will be available to you, the more likely it is you're going to have a positive outcome. But I think a lot of that is driven by special interests like the American Medical Association and other types of profit-driven organizations that are trying to place limits on the protocols that are available to all of us, because it makes them more profitable when we have to rely on their treatment protocols, right? So part of what we have to do as patients is we have to recognize that there's a world out there that's larger than the limited traditional world that's available to us in the acute care world, and that we are not treating an acute illness with Lyme disease. We are treating a chronic illness with Lyme disease. And because we're treating a chronic illness, we have to step out of the acute care system, which is really what the traditional medical system is, at least in the US, and I think in most Western countries.
Yes. I mean, the evidence is certainly there. Most of the herbs that kill the Borrelia bacteria, as well as Bartonella and and Babesia, which is a little bit different, but Bartonella's gram negative as well. Basically the evidence has been done in vitro. A herb like Cryptolepis has been shown, in vitro, in a petri dish, to work as efficiently as many of the antibiotics. And that body of work has grown. That body of work has done a lot on the essential oils, some of the Greek herbs, a lot of the African herbs, some of the Chinese herbs. It's absolutely there. Now, it's not, there haven't been any large human trials. And that's really, comes down to funding. But it used to be that before the 20th century, that, a body of work put together by, doctors and professionals and published was also considered evidence, not just randomized controlled evidence. But, the evidence for herbs is there in the literature if anybody wants to go to PubMed and have a look. The difficulty is that, yes, you could say that, well, you're going to get certain protocols, and there's lots of protocols that are out there. And somebody might have tried a protocol and said, well, actually, that's not going to work for me. Didn't make much difference. When protocols are put together by companies that don't have a practice, that don't see patients all the time, they've got to be really careful because they don't have people who are going to be able to deal with patients who have side effects or sudden problems and all the rest of it. So a lot of them are sold in very small bottles with drop doses, quite expensive. And so people are not necessarily taking a dose that's actually efficacious in their point of view. So, and this again comes back to this non-standardization of people. Some people are very sensitive, and small amounts of a substance make quite a big difference to them. And they might do well on a, some of these off-the-shelf protocols. Other people actually need to take herbs in much stronger doses. I'm like a rhino. I need really big doses to, to make a substantial difference to me. And also, there's something to do with the chemistry of the person with the herb as well, because a lot of the compounds, like for instance, flavonoids, which are some of these natural chemicals that are found in plants, they don't actually do anything on their own. What they do is they provide the, they provide a compound to your gut microbes, which then use it to make a medicinal metabolite. And this is really interesting because it means that, a lot of the work that's been done on herbs in research over the last 20 years kind of needs to be redone with the presence of some with the gut microbes there. But it also means sometimes that being a herbalist is a little bit like running a giant dating agency. I have 300 or 400 herbs out there, and I can see this pattern in you, and I've seen this pattern in other people, and they've responded quite well to this combination of herbs. And it may actually then produce a really quick and dramatic effect, but it may not, because you might actually be slightly more suited to something else because you have a different gut microbiome and you have a different body too. And but sooner or later, even if there is a little bit of experimentation at the start, we're going to find the things that really work for you. And when people have just tried off-the-shelf protocols and it hasn't worked for them, it's sometimes because they haven't taken the right combination for them, or even that they've taken them in the wrong order. Sometimes it's a question of it wasn't the right medicine at the right time. So you could get people to revisit that later when it is the right time. If that makes any sense.
It makes perfect sense. So the other thing, Mo, I'd like to talk with you about is your perspective on patterns. And you've talked about the patterns that thousands of years of Chinese medicine experiences made available to you, and the patterns that you've observed as a practitioner. And we here at Sick Boot Camp do the same thing. We're always looking for patterns. And after interviewing, on long form podcast, well over 400 people. Reading every major book that's been written on the subject, and coming in contact with millions of folks through various social media comments and channels and and emails, we've observed some patterns here at Sick Boot Camp. And one of the things we try to do is we try to take a pattern and then convert that into a framework, and then a framework into a formula so that folks will have a step-by-step guide for moving forward on their treatment journey. And one of the things that we've observed here at Sick Boot Camp on the healing journey is that the folks who seem to have the greatest degree of success follow a pattern that I'm going to even go out on a limb here. I think you may agree with, but I'd like your reaction. And I'm thinking you may agree with it not only because of this interview, but because of the other work that I've seen on YouTube that you've done. And we have something we call the Parm formula. Matt and I are both Italian, so we're going to have to come up with Parmesan or some other connection to to Italian culture and food. And generally, what we see is first people going through a prehabilitation phase where they're getting themselves ready for the next phase, which we call the assist phase. So we don't call it kill because we believe you should be assisting your immune system in managing the microbes or reducing the microbe load. And then after they go from that phase, they then move on to a rehabilitation phase. And after the rehabilitation phase, we see folks going on to a maintenance phase, where they are sort of building this toolbox that they take along with them, and then finally they understand their body, they understand their needs, and they're able to develop a lifestyle that supports them on the journey. Give me a reaction to PARM, which is prehabilitation, assist, repair, or rehabilitate, and then maintain.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way of describing the journey. Very good way of describing the journey. I'd concur with it.
Well, thank you. I, as I said, I didn't think I'd be surprised because I remember when I was watching one of your videos, you were talking about the repair and rebalance phase, and I really liked the way you had built out that framework. So one of the things that we ask folks to think about doing when they're new,
And
because
that's about a 2-year journey. I would say for the if you've got a team of people, because what's the point of going on a journey without anybody who knows the territory? That's why it's really helpful to have practitioners, who are specialists in something like Lyme. That's why we set up our clinic. People say to me, "Oh, how long is it going to be?" But I would say that yes, there's always some people who've been really ill and may even have done damaging treatments who might find it harder to respond and takes longer. And some people might, make really quick successes. But I would say that if you follow the 80-20 rule, it probably takes 80% of people around 2 years to reach the maintenance stage.
So one of the things that I really like about the way you teach is you teach through metaphor and use very powerful metaphors. And one of the metaphors that you had very powerfully used in one of the videos I had watched was you were describing Lyme disease, I think either as a car wreck or a train wreck. I don't remember which it was, but it was you were essentially arguing that it was a convergence of a number of different events that result in someone becoming chronically ill. And I think part of that you supported with the research you had done with defining who was getting sick and who wasn't getting sick in the forestry industry, where the overwhelming majority of people who are in the forestry industry were coming in contact with ticks and Lyme disease. A large number of them were testing positive with even traditional testing. At least they had antibodies that suggest they had come in contact with it. But a very small number of people were actually getting sick, right? And I think we're using that research and that data to teach from a particular metaphor. Do you remember using that metaphor? And can you share with us how you were describing what is causing folks to get sick from Lyme disease with that metaphor?
I can't remember the exact time that I was using that metaphor, but you're right. I'm a storyteller, so and I find it much easier for patients to understand what's going on and what needs to be done if they, understand the story of it. You don't need to know the exact medical breakdown. You just need to know, have a map of the path ahead. But so often, when you sit and talk to somebody, I always start with, what do you know about your birth? Because when you look at the progress of somebody's life, if somebody starts to say, I was born by cesarean, so I didn't get any gut microbes. And then as a child, I was a little bit ill. I had a lot of antibiotics. I used to get lots of ear infections and everything. And but other than that, things were fine. It was hard to adjust to secondary school. I felt quite anxious during my teens. I used to get then a lot of IBS and gut problems going on with my gut. And then I went off to university and I lived on chips for a year and then had this mega breakdown with my boyfriend at the, I really missed being at home and, I was hugely anxious and everything. And then we went on a field trip. I got bitten by a tick and I've had Lyme disease. In some ways, you can see this building up. You can see this imbalance in the person building up. And then finally, Lyme is just the, it's the straw that broke the camel's back. It's that thing that really pushes you over. Because if that person's health had been rebalanced at an earlier stage, their immune system might have been stronger in the first place.
So,
The other way I, look at it is a bit like, if you imagine that each one of us is actually an entire universe, which is probably quite realistic because if you emptied all the cells out of your body, extracted the water, the viruses, the phages, the bacteria, the fungi, which are 10 trillion times more than our own cells, and refilled us, you'd only about reach your knee with your own cells.
right. We're more non-us than we are us, right?
And if you imagine it in a little bit on the sort of Star Wars scale, we are this universe of so many different things. And Lyme is just one rebel force that has entered on a planet and part of the universe. And we have our immune system, the Jedi Force, that are patrolling and keeping everything in harmony in the universe. But when the immune system is distracted and coping with something else, the terrible time you're having with your boss who's a real bully or whatever, what happens is that because that the focus is there, it gives an opportunity for rebel colonies to build up and launch an attack from elsewhere.
I love the Star Wars metaphor. I hadn't heard that one before. So maybe I hadn't shared that one publicly, and it'll be the tick boot camp metaphor that we can all you can only offer through us. So one you and Cassidy had a really powerful conversation about belief, right? And the role that belief plays in healing. And one of the challenges that I think folks have with using traditional tools like identifying patterns, developing frameworks, and ultimately creating formulas and following formulas is they take the position, hey, I'm a viral individual. This is a polymicrobial infection. It's going to present differently in every single person. And they sort of get to this place where they don't believe they can heal, right? And of course, that becomes more destructive to the healing than anything else. So how would you respond to the folks who, make the case that because Lyme disease is a polymicrobial, at least by the tick boot camp definition, polymicrobial, multi-systemic, chronic infectious disease that is now going to be presenting very differently in the bio individual person who is neurologically individual, who is, of course, made up not just genetically, but with a bunch of different with a great deal of biodiversity and gut diversity. How can we come up with a framework that would work for folks, or can we come up with a framework that has enough flexibility within the framework that as we go through the stages of healing, we can build what is necessary for each person in the pre-rehabilitation phase and build what's necessary in the assist or the kill phase and what's necessary for each person in the rehab and then ultimately the maintenance phase. So give me a reaction to first patterns and converting them into frameworks and whether or not that's something that can be done with adequate flexibility for bio-individualized people who are suffering from a polymicrobial multi-systemic infection.
Yeah, well, as much as I look for patterns, and well, not just myself, but with it, my team, as much as we're always looking for patterns and then seeing which frameworks have worked with different patterns, at the end of the day, what we do as herbalists is individualized treatment. I'm not going, I might start with a framework that has worked with this pattern before. But I can very quickly see that if it's not going to work for this individual, that I need to do something different. And that's, I find that very, in stimulating and very rewarding. And I think also, sometimes you don't know enough at the time. Sometimes, I'll be reading something and I think, damn it, I wish I had given, this patient of mine this like a year ago, but I've only found out about it. And sometimes I'll go back to patients who I might not have seen for a while and re-engage and say, hey, there's this thing, and I just feel it's really going to suit you. But it's, I suppose it's, what I was saying earlier is that, it's like with off-the-shelf frameworks, it's not necessarily going to work for everyone at every time. But at the same time, there's enough of a similarity in patterns and things that, we normally have somewhere, somewhere to go, somewhere to go with it. There's enough that matches up. I mean, at the moment, I'm doing quite a lot of research with Lyme-induced gastroparesis that Dr. Virginia Scher called Bell's palsy of the gut, which we've had quite a lot of success treating with a combination of, different herbs and supplements, but also with acupuncture and vagus nerve stimulation. And it's been very interesting working with this particular group of patients to see, okay, we now have enough understanding of this pattern to have a framework, which is where we start. But, they're not, patients aren't identical, so they're not always going to respond in exactly the same way. We have to be flexible. We have to be willing to be versatile. We have to be willing to step out of our own frameworks, because at the end of the day, you're dealing with an individual. And, it's possible, people do ask, I've been, bitten by Lyme. I've got this, polymicrobial infection. I don't know if it'll ever, if I'll ever not have it. And the truth is, we don't know. We don't know if you can ever exterminate Lyme from the body. But what we do know is that you can banish it to that far-flung, planet in your internal universe. And as long as you keep your immune system on the ball, you're not going to have a recurrence. Because, I've seen people, I had a patient quite recently, she'd been bitten at 15, correctly identified, given antibiotics, she got better. She went on to have a pretty healthy life. And then, in her early 40s, she had a major relationship meltdown. She jacked in her job. She went traveling. She got mugged in, I think, the Philippines or something. She got dengue fever. And the next thing, she's got Lyme. No fresh tick bite or fresh infection. But you can see, again, that sort of train wreck type situation in that, all of these stresses weakening the immune system, and this is there again. But to me, a cure isn't elimination of bacteria. I mean, I can guarantee you that all three of us here have some E. coli, we've got some, Staphylococcus aureus, we've got all sorts, we've got some Candida, we've got all sorts of other bugs in us. We're not, we're not trying to eliminate them. Having Helicobacter in your gut as a child gives you some protection against things like asthma. And they found in African studies that if you eliminate all of the parasitic worms out of children's guts, they go on to develop, a lot more allergic conditions and things. Our bodies are perfectly happy to live in a multiverse, but you have to keep that immune balance. Otherwise, things get out of hand.
Right, and which is why in most cases when we interview folks who have Lyme disease, either they don't remember a tick bite or there's a long gap in time between the time they were bitten by a tick and when they ultimately became ill, right? Because it rarely goes from bite to chronic illness because we really are a multiverse. I really love, again, another one of the metaphors that you're using to teach us today. But we are really more, we're more bug than we're not bug. We have more diversity in us than we have us. We have more, again, bugs in us than we have cells in us. And really the goal should not be to eradicate a particular microbe because you're right. I would venture to argue, at least where I live, I'm going to quote Dr. Rawls again. Dr. Rawls said that if we had a competent Lyme disease test and we tested everyone on Long Island, he would venture to guess 95% of the people on the Long Island in loyalist communities would be harboring the Lyme bacteria, right? I mean, Borrelia, right? And I think he's right. I'm sure I am harboring it, but I'm also sure that my immune system is healthy and I'm able to manage it, right? So I think that is an important, you know, mindset lesson that you're teaching us as well, Mo, because our goal should not be to eradicate Lyme. Our goal should be to heal our immune system and just bring that microbe in balance with everything else. Right. And not just believe that the goal should be to kill. So, and that's why I love the conversation we're having about rehabilitate, right? Because you're talking about making sure that you are building a foundation to go forward with the removal or the reduction of the microbes, right? And in many cases, that's because when you're using the car wreck metaphor in one of your other videos, it was really because you're not eating well and you're not sleeping and you're under a lot of emotional stress and you haven't developed a stress reduction set of protocols and the list goes on and on of all those things that are resulting in you really if somebody was watching the car driving down the road, it's going to run into the wall, right? I mean, it's coming. It's just a matter of time because unfortunately, with in modern society where we have mass communications and we have and social media and all kinds of consumer demands and expectations and all of these different chemicals that we're coming in contact with and all of these different electronic waves that we're coming in contact with. I mean, when you put that whole combination of threats together, we then find ourselves out of balance. What that does is it puts us in a position where these microbes that we could in most cases regularly manage pretty easily and have for millions of years that we've existed in in some form of humans or humanoids, that that it's that that loss of balance that causes us to get sick.
Yeah. But that's not to take away from the fact that antimicrobial herbs or antibiotics do have an important part to play.
Absolutely.
But they you kind of need to have a sort of stepped process in that, if you take too much, you can have other deleterious side effects because the system that you're treating becomes weakened overall. There's a very good... antibiotic, when the name is antibios, it's anti-life, so it's going to attack, more in your universe than just your Lyme colony, unfortunately. And, what you really want to do is to give enough antimicrobial herbs or antibiotics for the patient then to be able to have a period where they're investing in resilience and then see where they are. If they start to sort of slip back a little bit, then give them some more. So, I mean, one of the things that Dr. Lambert and I have worked on over the last sort of few years is a sort of, we just call it the pulse protocol. So we're not talking about short-term pulsing of things where, you're doing something on different days of the week. We're talking about over time. And that was really came out of trying to, having some patients who'd taken, a course of antibiotics, got better, being supported with herbs through that rehabilitation process, but then started to slip and go down. And then they'd end up going back on another long course of antibiotics. And it was a question of, well, if we can get them to a point where if we notice that they're starting to slip a little bit, of just giving them much shorter doses of antimicrobial herbs or antibiotics, just to literally sort of, it's a bit like whack-a-mole, as soon as you start to see the Lyme coming up again, you give it a sharp tap on the head, but you continue that journey of strengthening and rebalancing the system. And that seems to have, some really good outcomes. A lot of people have got better that, and they've stopped having to slipping back and having to go back on antibiotics every year or two. Anyway, with to be quite honest, with the with the antimicrobial herbs, you know, very often they're doing more than just killing bacteria as well, which is interesting. I mean, soon the spring will be coming. There'll be Japanese knotweed, which is one of the main herbs used against Lyme. It's been shown to be effective against Borrelia and Bartonella in vitro. It's particularly good because it's a high source of resveratrol, very good for arthritis and Lyme arthritis and things in the joints. But, you know, it tastes like rhubarb. You can eat the shoots. You taste like rhubarb. And that's the other thing, you know, I mean, one of the things that I do when I'm, you know, not in clinic is I teach people about foraging and plants and mushrooms and things like that. So I'm very aware of the fact that we eat far less variety of plants now than we used to in the past. And all of them have these incredible compounds that if we were to eat more plants in terms of a greater diversity, we'd probably be getting a lot of the, you know, the medicines that help to keep our universe in balance before we got ill too.
Wow. I have a question for you based off of what you talked about a couple minutes ago. And then I want to go back to what you were just touching on with the things that we need to eat. But you were talking about the patient that she had like a relapse, and currently I am in a relapse myself, and wondering back to patterns that you've seen with relapses in patients with the treatments. Do you often find that going back and treating kind of the same way that they once did, if that was with you, that same pattern that you treated them with before is that will work again? Or is now, because the system has more kind of variations going on within it, the universe has different people at play, that you have to kind of start from ground zero and work on a new treatment basis?
Gosh, it depends on the person, and depends at the point of the relapse, and it depends also on how quickly they've responded to having a relapse. Mm-hmm. So it might be a relapse of, it could be a relapse to do with the supportive systems of the body, which have become out of balance again because of stress. It could be to do with a flare up of the bacteria again. The two are not necessarily the same thing, but will very often feel the same. And then sometimes, you know, talking about, you know, the point in it, you know, sometimes when people are getting better, they have some of their original symptoms come back, which they feel is like a relapse. And that's actually really to do in a lot of ways about how the body copes with infection in the first place. You know, so, you know, when you're first invaded by a bacteria or a virus, it's at a superficial level and your body will throw it off. So you will typically sweat, you will vomit or feel nauseous and vomit, or you'll have diarrhea, or you'll cough it out. You know, this is at a superficial level and your body's doing everything it can to throw it off. Right. Once the infection gets deeper into the body knows it's not going to throw it off so easily. And very often those initial symptoms quieten down. And the body is then more concerned with not letting the infection that's, you know, being carried around in the blood and is altering the nature of blood, you know, from reaching the organs, and then it's starting to affect the organs. So very often, you know, it wouldn't be appropriate to use herbs to treat the illness at a superficial level, you know, making somebody sweat, if by this stage it's, you know, affecting the heart and giving you palpitations. But at the same time, you know, once you've used herbs at the core level and started to move that infection out of the body, very often the body will go into, you know, sweats and shivers or nausea, you know, at the end of treatment, because that's its reaction to where the infection feels to the body that it's in. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I feel like it resonates. I've been through that.
Yeah.
So I get that one.
And sometimes it's to do also with cleansing or detoxifying the system. Okay. You know, even once bacteria are dead, you know, their exoskeletons, their bodies can float around, particularly in things like the joints where there's not a lot of blood and fluid getting things out. And the immune system will still come across these occasionally and go, ah, and have a little freak out. So the process of detoxification. And a lot of people, and I think this comes from the fact that there are probably more nutritionists in general alternative practice than herbalists. There's a huge amount of focus on gut detoxification. But in actual fact, the place that most dead bodies get put is in the lymph. And it's really, really important to keep the lymph moving, because unlike the heart, it doesn't have a pump and it relies on you being active. And when you're bedbound or, so ill that you're not really walking around and things, everything can become sluggish as well. So there's a point at which you have to balance sort of, different types of detoxification with movement and other things, because otherwise some of those symptoms are still going to feel like they're very present.
Yeah, I always say that detoxing and exercise are part of my treatment. I consider like the herbs that I take, I use an infrared sauna, and I exercise at least once a day with, like, if it's just a 10 minute walk, if that's all I can do, just to get the things moving. And those are, and then food, the food that I eat, and all of that combined, I feel over the last 12 years is what has seen the best improvements with. And I just think that it's so, so important. So it's good to hear it from someone who's actually doing the work. But I wanted to, back on the food, you were just talking about the herbs. I can't remember the Japanese. I can't remember what you said.
Japanese knotweed. Yeah.
Yes, that's like coming up. And just top of your head, top three or five that we don't currently use in society on a regular basis anymore that you think people would benefit from if we had them back in our like daily usage.
Dandelion.
Okay. I love dandelion root tea.
Dandelion. I mean, up until the First World War, every respectable cookery book had a recipe for dandelion greens, either steamed and served with butter, salt and pepper, or used in a salad. Because dandelion, to us here in Europe, dandelion was to the British what rocket is in the Mediterranean. And in Chinese medicine, both the leaves and the root are taken to treat infections. But they also, they have an action on the liver. So they're really good for detoxifying. So dandelion is a real, and it's slightly diuretic, so it keeps everything moving as well. So dandelion's a really good one that most people could find. Japanese knotweed. I mean, most of it, unfortunately, gets sprayed with poison because it's quite invasive and it can get into people's house foundations and then they have insurance problems. But if you cut the spears, it comes up like sort of purple asparagus. And if you cut the spears off and cook them, it's just like eating, rhubarb, but a little less acidic. And, we had some in a big ditch near us that I think some builders must have just dumped by the side of the road rather than taking to a disposal place. And there was a great big colony of it. And I ate so much of it that the poor thing died. So you don't need to poison it. You just need to eat it out of existence. Cleavers, I don't know if you know that. It's sometimes called goosegrass. It's an incredibly good herb for lymphatic clearance. And it's also when people reach a plateau in healing, they've been doing really well and then suddenly they plateau. Very often cleavers is what gets things moving again, or any of the, the lymphatic tonics. It's kind of like the one that they used to be an advert for Heineken that said it reaches the parts that other beers cannot reach. And I always think of cleavers a little like that. It reaches the parts other herbs cannot reach, very often. Seems to reactivate that healing process. Nettle, an incredible anti-inflammatory and antihistamine and generally all round very, very nutritious herb. But there are so many of them. I couple of years ago, I lived only on wild food for a year just to see if it was still possible. Someone had to, you know. And I ended up eating over 300 species of plants. And, you know, 90% of that was gathered within a few miles of where I live, you know, which is sort of central Scotland commuter belt, semi-rural, but nevertheless, it's not anything special.
As we wind down, I want to talk with you about how the work that you've been doing is working on you, how this has been transformational for you. And I'd like to there's actually a question I've been wanting to ask you since I first started doing my research on you, because of your book, The Wilderness Cure. Again, just an observation that I had made that I wanted to share with you. So I grew up on Long Island here in New York, and as I shared with you, it's always been a sick endemic community all during my life. In fact, as an old man, I actually my contact with ticks and tick diseases predates Burgdorfer's public alleged discovery of the bacteria. We were more concerned about Rocky Mountain spotted fever as a disease that was, of concern and we were aware of prior to Lyme. And the two things that I always remember from my childhood is this invasive plant that was all over the place, which I only recently discovered, is Japanese knotweed. It is invasive where we live. It's everywhere. I live next door to a vacant lot, and there is a huge colony of Japanese knotweed there. And quite frankly, if you walked into that lot, you would find a number of ticks all over the place. So do you think it's a coincidence that there is this proliferation of Japanese knotweed where I live when there is a proliferation of ticks? Or is that really something that you think is consistent the way balance is ultimately developed in I'll use the more secular term, universe? And is it the way that the earth responds and protects us? And is this something that we should be taking into consideration as people who are looking to find solutions to the illnesses that we're trying to manage?
Yes, it's really interesting once you look at the more sort of esoteric side of things, how the herbs that we need are the ones that appear and present ourselves. And I don't know if you've read Robin Wall Kimmerer's wonderful book, Braiding Sweetgrass.
I purchased it. I haven't read it yet.
Well, she talks in it about, you know, one of the or, you know, early origin stories and about how when mankind was created, it was because a pregnant woman fell from the heavens to earth. And the animals and plants, you know, and everybody took pity on this woman who then gave birth to the first human, the first man. And the animals gave their, you know, their fur, their coats, their very lives to feed and nourish her, their milk and all the rest of it. And all the plants promised that each one would have a gift for mankind in their hour of need. And you know, looking at a vacant lot, an abandoned lot, you know, something that was concreted over and then just been left by humans, you know, what happens? You know, cracks start to appear and plants start to come. But not just any old plants. You don't just get masses of wildflowers and the first thing. You get the thistles and the docks and the nettles. And they are pioneer species which then remediate the soil. You know, they remediate it and they rebalance it. And once they've done that for 7 or 8 years, they then give way, having made soil, having made a new environment, they then give way to the more beautiful, more delicate plants that come up. And when you look at our own bodies, you know, when you actually start that rehabilitation process, it's the docks, it's the nettles, it's the thistles. You know, the thistles that act on the liver, the docks that, you know, that act as blood tonics, you know, the nettle, which is such a strengthening herb, that are also those pioneer rewilding species in our bodies too.
That is really, that's powerful.
That's merely my observation because I spend a lot of time looking.
So, can you tell folks first where they could find your book, and then where they could get in touch with you if they were interested in working with you or learning more about you?
Certainly. My book's called The Wilderness Cure by Mo Wild, and I think in the States you can get it through Amazon. Unfortunately, you don't seem to be able to get the podcast, the audio book there, but you can certainly get it in print. And here it's I mean, in the UK, it's available from a number of independent booksellers, and you can also get the audio book too, which I narrated. And in terms of the clinic, we're called the Clade Clinic, that's CLAID.com, cladeclinic.com. Clade just stands for COVID, Lyme, and infectious disease, and sounds a bit Scottish. And we work under Napier's, the work with Napier's, the herbalists as well. So people can get in touch that way. And, as I said, we're a team of seven. I set us up very much as a team right from the very beginning. Because if one person tries to do this, they're going to get burnout. There's far more people that are unwell than there are practitioners. So right from the very beginning, we are very, very open with our knowledge. We run a conference. I think the next one conference is going to be at the end of August. A 2-day conference, training other practitioners and people, sharing what we know quite freely, because knowledge is empowering. But within our own team, any herbalist that you see has the support of me and the others as well, because we can each of us only see a limited amount of people. But as a team, we're all much stronger.
Monica Mowild, thank you so much for joining us here at Tick Boot Camp and helping us understand the importance of adding an herbalist to our team. And thank you, Cassidy Colbert, for joining me as the tick co as my Tick Boot Camp co-host this week.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank
you.
you, Mo, for from a patient's perspective. Thank you for speaking on this topic that I feel has been lacking in our society and community. So thank you, and thank you for the work that you do.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.